Well, for me, the journey to what I do now, journalism, began by accident, really. It began when, as a student at Harvard, in the early 80s, both at Tufts and at Harvard and at many schools, a very big issue was divestment from South Africa, from apartheid South Africa. In Harvard's case, Harvard had over $1 billion of its endowment invested in companies doing business in South Africa. Tufts, I don't recall the exact figures, but it was also very heavily involved. And so across the country, students were trying to get universities to divest as a protest, and not just a symbolic protest, but really to have an impact, to apply economic pressure. So while this was going on in college, when I...
In fact, I think Barnum Hall was taken over
Ballou
in
Hall.
Anti-apartheid.
Yes, Ballou Hall was... There was a sit-in in Ballou Hall, and some friends of mine were actually there, and I had came to visit them because as they were in Ballou Hall, they were hungry, and so the anti-apartheid groups from Harvard brought donuts to Tufts. This is what we felt could help sustain them. I think in both cases, both at Harvard and Tufts, the divestment movements played a big role. You know, Harvard, after years of saying it wouldn't divest, did divest. And it had huge symbolic impact. And Massachusetts ultimately became one of the first states to take some of the most proactive divestment steps, banning any companies that the state did business with from purchasing goods and services from South Africa. But when I graduated Harvard, also at that time, a lot of the activism on campus was around Central America, Nicaragua, the Contra War against Nicaragua. This was also going on. Many friends were going to Central America. But I was intrigued by Africa, where no one was going. And one of the people who was, so I decided my then girlfriend, now wife, and I decided we would go, Sue Minter, to Southern Africa. And throughout college and the protest movement, the word South Africa was always preceded by boycott. So you didn't ever actually talk about engaging South Africa. So we decided to go to the country next door, Zimbabwe, which had just had a revolution, thrown out a white apartheid regime, Rhodesia. And then as we were looking at the map and planning this trip, we thought, well, we could go to South Africa. And our initial reaction was kind of was like, well, no, you don't do that. So I remember going to a friend of ours, a man who was really somebody who had inspired a lot of us around the Boston area, Temba Vilakazi, who was the African National Congress representative here. The ANC is Nelson Mandela's party. It was banned at the time. And Temba was an extremely fiery and inspirational speaker. He spoke here and all the college campuses. And I remember saying to Temba, so I'm going to Southern Africa, and what do you think about the idea of going to South Africa? And he said, if you can get in, you should go. He said, but if you go, you have a responsibility to tell people what you saw when you came back, when you come back. And those words really stuck with me, and that became the beginning of doing journalism for me. I hadn't really planned on it. I had just graduated college, and here we were going to South Africa, and where there were just about no journalists. So I arrive in South Africa, I start
Western
calling,
no
what's
Western
it? No Western journalists, excuse me. So I start calling everyone from the Boston Globe to the Progressive in the Nation, and everybody is saying, well, we love stories. Also, South Africa had kicked out most journalists who were writing anything critical. It was a very bizarre kind of relationship and profile that the Western journalists had to maintain there. They get too critical, they get kicked out. So I went as a tourist with Sue, and we hitchhiked around the country. And it was a remarkable experience to see the country through the eyes of the people who picked us up. Black South Africans and white South Africans. Every ride was a different world. Each one would put us up. We'd stay in the black townships, and we'd stay in white homes. We stumbled upon the meetings of a white anti-apartheid, white anti-war movement. These were young white men who were refusing to fight. And I ended up writing the first story about this in the U.S. press. Nobody knew there was a white anti-war movement of draft resistors. So I think of those words that Temba told me, and I just saw him last year because I kind of recounted some of the Boston area national activism in this book, No Easy Victories, and recounted the story of meeting Temba. And out of a series of trips to South Africa came this book, Fault Lines, which was a chronicle of going back to South Africa when Nelson Mandela became president. And we decided, now I had a, at that time, four-year-old daughter in tow, to go and see history as it was unfolding. We didn't know how we were going to make this work. I was a pretty young journalist at the time, but I felt like it was going to India when Gandhi was around, or, you know, seeing America when Martin Luther King was here, and telling the stories of people. And I think, you know, one of the greatest expressions of activism is caring enough to go there and bring back the stories. And as Temba said, you have a responsibility to tell those stories. So I've tried to do that ever since.
You know, our late beloved dad came up with the title for this book. Everything is a family endeavor, as we were throwing around these ideas when David finished the book. And he said, what about Fault Lines? And we all thought, well, if people aren't interested in this country enough in South Africa, maybe David will get a cross audience from people who care about earthquakes, and they'll think, and then they'll learn something about South Africa. But Dave, maybe very quickly, could you talk about the first chapter, which is, I mean, this book is such an interesting juxtaposition of, it's all these dualities of people, black and white, on two sides of a fault line, but the story of the torturer and the tortured.
Yeah, this intrigued me, and it was one of the things you could see in South Africa. So imagine a country post a dictatorship of some sort or a calamity like apartheid. The country had been torn apart, neighbor against neighbor, black against white. And now Mandela's president, we wipe out. You can't imagine, I mean, you talk about Rube Goldberg schemes. That was South Africa. Because they took the idea of racial separation, you know, they made it a science, really. And so every community had three separate governments, a white, a black, and often sometimes four and five, an Indian and a colored. Separate town councils, separate boards of education. So you had these completely impossible, unwieldy structures. And so out of this, in 1994, this is all very recent, they wipe the whole thing away and they go to reinvent their country. But first they got to deal with the past. And so they set up this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And this was the process. This is when I arrived in South Africa. So from town to town, because what you're dealing with is, if this were a community meeting, if this were the Truth and Reconciliation would go to each town. Why? Because in this room would be, among you, there would be people who had been victims and perpetrators. You would have cops who might have tortured, might have killed someone over here's brother, sister, mother, father. So I went to find those people, and I found a government assassin, a secret policeman, and I found the person he tried to kill but failed to. This was very much the story of South Africa. How do you go forward in light of what has happened within this very room, within this very community? And it's a very...
That story was of
Frank Chikane, who, and this was the story of a crisscrossing trajectories of these two men, the secret policeman who really ruled South Africa. His name was Paul Erasmus, operated literally in secret, tried to poison the underwear of this fiery reverend who was the head of the South African Council of Churches. His story, as he became exposed, he fell apart. He went from being the hunter to being the hunted. His old colleagues tried to hunt him down because he began spilling the secrets of the secret police. Frank Chikane went from being almost murdered to being the right-hand man of President Thabo Mbeki.
And it's amazing about Frank Chikane. No one could figure out what was going wrong with him. He took a trip to Namibia, right?
Right.
And he got so incredibly, incredibly sick. And he was rushed back to...
He was rushed back to South Africa. And then because the poisoning had failed... Well, they had poisoned a bunch of his clothes in his suitcase. This is a guy who was traveling around the world.
Know. What it was.
Then he came to give a talk. Oh, his wife was at the University of Wisconsin. She got some sort of fellowship. So he came to Wisconsin, put on the same clothes that had been poisoned by Paul Erasmus, fell ill, ended up in the University of Wisconsin hospital, and they figured it out that he had been poisoned.
Every time he went home, he went to the hospital, he would get better, though he was near death, hovering near death, because they had put him in hospital clothes. No one could figure out what was shutting down his entire system. He would go home, and he would get sick again. And this went back and forth until they figured out it was his clothes, it was his underwear.
And you know, the whole experience of watching the Truth and Reconciliation Commission operate was really watching the power of stories. In South Africa, they decided, The commission was rightly criticized for trading justice for truth, and that's a fair criticism. But what had happened in South Africa is they had tried to go after, to prosecute the biggest fish, the top general of the South African military, and the courts had failed. So these guys were getting off. P.W. Botha, the former strongman of apartheid, so they're looking at this going, what can we do? They're hiring rich lawyers. They're getting away with it. And they decided, well, if we can't prosecute him, maybe we can at least get the truth. And I think in journalism, that's also what we have the power and ability to do. And since you mentioned earthquakes, I want to turn that to you, because recently you went to Haiti. And one of the things that strikes me in seeing some of the reports that you do, here you are, you're based in New York, you're not a foreign correspondent, but when Katrina hit New Orleans, you went in, you have a limited amount of time, this isn't your home city, and yet in a short period of time, you went in, went immediately into the devastated African-American communities there, found people like Malik Rahim, a former Black Panther, now a community activist in New Orleans, and bring out the story of a Black community under siege, being hunted by the police, being accused of being looters. You immediately, within a day, are reporting on the presence of Blackwater, you know, a place that we associate as being foreign mercenaries. Here they are patrolling the streets of Katrina, of New Orleans. In Haiti, we're getting a massive inundation. CNN, these lavishly endowed media outlets, these images, and yet you go in, and in a short period of time, are speaking with doctors who are saying, there is no security threat here. This has been launched as a security operation. There is none. How is it that you can go in to these places, which often are under a media spotlight, and bring back stories that no one else is telling?
Well, on the issue of Blackwater in New Orleans, I'll just say, you know, I went there with my colleague Jeremy Scahill, who was a producer for Democracy Now! At the time. And as he started to investigate Blackwater, he ended up writing this incredible best-selling book that has changed the frame of discussion around mercenary companies called Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And I encourage everyone to read it. With Haiti, I went there with our senior producer, Sharifa Del Kadous, with Elizabeth Press, our filmmaker, and Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté. It was a few days after the earthquake struck, and we didn't have much time. You know, we do a daily global broadcast, a global grassroots broadcast, and that's important. It's not about going to Washington and bringing out that small circle of pundits that you see in all the rest of the media. Those pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. It's about bringing out the voices of the grassroots. In Haiti, it was about changing the frame of the discussion. As we were seeing in the media, the concern of the possibility of looting, seeing the images of people digging for their loved ones and the UN forces or US that coming to protect the grocery store as opposed to help the people who are digging for their loved ones inside. We went there fast. And we went to the hospitals of Port-au-Prince. The first night we were in this Catholic parish hospitality house, not wanting to take any food from anyone, a little sip of soup, and then they cleared off the table. Some doctors from Denver Children's Hospital had come in. They did the best they could to wash their hands. And then they laid a man on the table. There were 1,000 people in the soccer field in the backyard. No one would sleep inside. Everyone was outside because of these aftershocks. And they brought in this man whose foot was crushed, and we watched them amputate his foot. The good news was they had brought anesthesia from Denver, so rare in Haiti. They have ibuprofen or Motrin if they're lucky. Usually it's nothing. Now, amputations, it is a nation of amputees right now. I mean, we're talking about a cataclysm of biblical proportions. You know, the earthquake in Chile was 500 times worse, and yet 1,000 times fewer deaths. We're talking 300,000 deaths in Haiti. The Asian tsunami that hits like 9 countries suffered less casualties than in the small, tiny half island of Haiti. Chile, the same. We're talking about a very different history, though, because in Haiti, the relationship it has had with the United States, it is so important to go back to the beginning and put everything in its proper context. Haiti, the small island nation, born of a slave rebellion in 1804, the oldest black republic in the world. The U.S. would not recognize Haiti for decades because the slave-owning U.S. Congress members were afraid it would inspire slaves in the United States to rise up. And so they only recognized it in 1862, the country born in 1804. Then the U.S. Marines occupied from 1915 to 34. And then when the first democratically elected president took office, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 1991, within 10 months, he was ousted, unfortunately, in a US-backed coup. And it's very important to tell the story because of the enforced poverty, the level of exploitation of Haiti by countries like the United States and France. France, which exacted reparations from Haiti from 1825 to World War II, for Haiti to pay France for the slaves it could no longer use. One of the first things President Aristide wanted to do, one, increase the minimum wage before the coup, and two, was to sue France for those reparations that it had paid for so long. And so it's important to understand that, to understand the difference, say, between Haiti and Chile. Because if you fly over Haiti, you've got Dominican Republic and Haiti on this island. It's cut in half. Green Dominican Republic, brown Haiti, because it's deforested. The people are so impoverished, they go into the hills, into the mountains, and they cut down the trees for charcoal, to burn it for charcoal, something to sustain them. And when President Obama talks about rebuilding and redevelopment, we also have to talk about redemption. Redemption of the U.S. relationship with Haiti. It's not about charity. It's about restoring to Haiti what we have taken. And so we went to Haiti, we went to Port-au-Prince, and then we journeyed to the epicenter through Carrefour and Gracier and Léogâne, the epicenter where the first Haitian flag was made. And as the U.S. and U.N. were talking about, as David said, ensuring security before they could deliver any aid, we saw the thousands of pounds of aid at the airport. And here were people completely bereft, completely desperate, covered in cement ash because they were clawing through the rubble, digging for their grandfathers, for their babies. They would form these circles with hammers and mallets. One man said, "My grandfather, I know he is here underneath the house at Pancake because he had just gone in to get his wife, this man's grandmother,
tea. He said, I know he's here, and I will dig until I bring his body out. And another man had just dug out his little baby boy, who was 1 year old, and we saw the bassinet. He was then buried under the reeds. All they wanted was the earth-moving equipment. They needed water. They needed food. And the Western authorities were talking about ensuring security. When we went to the airport, there were thousands of bottles, among other things, of Aquafina. And then I saw a truck roll up. And we were recording all of this, and we have it in our series. And you can go to democracynow.org to see it. So I thought, maybe there is some hope. And as the men were taking the bottles and they were filling this truck, I said, where are you taking the bottles of Aquafina? And they said, to the U.S. Embassy. It is very important to just show up, to bring out the voices of people at the grassroots, and then you make up your own minds. That's the key. The media can be a grassroots forum, can be the answer to corporate globalization. You know, corporations have had so much power in controlling the flow of information. The internet, if we keep it open and free, and not let the telecoms and the cable companies write the legislation that would privatize the internet, if we keep it open and free, this is the greatest force for grassroots globalization.
And it, you know, that idea of just showing up, and I think as students here, people, you know, finishing school, and you wonder, what can you do out there to make a difference? I mean, I know, you know, for me, just going to Africa, a place where Westerners were not going in great numbers, and to bring back, you know, and now there's more opportunity than ever, I mean, with all the independent media outlets, with the internet, with all the variety of ways, even just social media and communicating, you know, virally with people. I do think that, I think it's very helpful to go with organizations and connected, but I also think just going is very powerful.
And David, you just go right here at home. You investigate what's going on in this country when we're involved in one war after another, from Iraq to Afghanistan. You're looking here at home at students and recruiting, and have done some remarkable pieces in Mother Jones and other publications about the story that most people, even parents who have kids in high school, for example, don't realize how early kids are being recruited. And maybe some of you students know the story well, because maybe you were recruited yourselves.
Well, I found this story the way often I find stories, which is locally. You know your communities better than anybody, any experts do. So I just read in my local paper at one point about a local high school in Vermont where the principal was shocked because a military recruiter came to her and demanded contact information for every student in high school. Well, this is, you know, the golden key. Everybody wants it. Verizon wants it. Walmart wants it. Everybody wants the names and addresses of these kids. So she said, as she says to everybody who asked that, no, of course you can't have that. But then was told that a new national supposed education law had just been passed called No Child Left Behind, which now required that schools all across the country turn over all contact information on all students to the military, a little-known provision tucked into the 800-some pages. So this began my journey into the world of recruiting, which continues to this day. Most recently, a story in Mother Jones that I did about stealth recruiting, how playing video games that kids are playing, test preparation websites. So teachers are sending their students to SAT prep online sites. Little do the students know that this one of the most popular test prep websites is run by the U.S. Army. And in fact, if you're not vigilant, one of the things that you click as you click through to get to the questions is something that allows a recruiter to monitor your progress in real time. So it's a website called marchtosuccess.com. So these are some of the ways that the data mining that is going on of young people, and now the Army is using a marketing, the same marketing people who work for BMW, AOL, and Starbucks, to do something called custom segmentation of the market, so that it used to be they'd have to find you at the mall, and depending on how you dress, maybe tailor their pitch to you. Well, now they know down to even apartment buildings in a city what the young people in that building, what they like to do, what their preferences are. So they now can start that conversation with you knowing that everybody in this neighborhood, you know, is into hunting and guns and ammo, or is into cars, or is a very high number of people, you know, who are, whatever their interest may be.
But in the schools, you have the chance not
yes,
to
and
have
in
that
the schools, you have, in Chicago, for example, where I visited, Chicago is the most highly militarized school district in America. And there I saw, now, officially, students can't be recruited, well, 18, but if they have permission of the parents, 17. There I saw the military in classrooms of kids down to 11 and 12 years old. They're wearing berets, and military berets, uniforms. It's not officially sanctioned by the Pentagon because it can't be, so it's all done unofficially by military recruiters and instructors who are teaching these kids. Basically, the recruiting pipeline is down to the age of 11. So, but I want to end on one note, because Dale is being very good about reminding us that we're out of time. Whatever it is we're doing here is very much inspired by our parents. And our mom passed away a couple of months ago, and Amy and I were with her to the end, a very sudden and unexpected. And I just thought, and she would undoubtedly be here if for this conversation if she were around. We didn't always listen to her good advice. When we first told her we were thinking of writing books together, she said, "That's a terrible idea. You're never going to talk to each other again. You can always write books. You can't always have a brother and sister to talk to." And so with that, we began three books over 5 or 6 years. But mostly we listened to her. Two of the three books are dedicated to her and our dad. So I thought I'd ask you a question that we've been asked from time to time, which is, how does the house we grew up in, the environment, and mom and dad, how do you think it informs what you do today?
Well, our parents and our grandparents were incredible role models for us. My grandmother, our mother's mother, lived to the age of 108. And when I told the story once at a talk in California, a woman came up to me and said, "Oh my gosh, I just came from my grandmother's 105th birthday." And she stood up at her birthday, this woman told me, and said, "Oh, to be 100 again." But her daughter was our mom, and she was a remarkable woman, and she taught us so much. My mom taught women's history and literature in local community colleges in Long Island, and she taught it for continuing ed. So it was, truck drivers, cops, firefighters who wanted to make more money, and if they got more credits, they would get a higher salary. And they thought, what could be an easier night course than some chick lit, right? Some women's literature, whatever that is. And she would introduce them to Toni Morrison and to Virginia Woolf. And soon those classes of guys, they would bring their wives, maybe their daughter. "That little, my precious child," you know, this dad would say, "suddenly has become this woman I don't know. And my wife, why is she so angry?" And they're learning everything. This was the 70s, you know, the continuation of women's liberation, and they're learning through great works of literature how to understand their families. And it's what our mother and father taught us about how to travel the world through literature, through writing, my mother was an incredible adventurer. She, even after my dad died 10 years ago, they always traveled together. She went to Iran, she went to Turkey, she went to Israel, she went to Palestine. Our parents met at a Hebrew-speaking camp called Masada, and
They went to camp with Noam Chomsky and his wife, Carol. And I was just here on Saturday introducing Noam at the Harvard Memorial Church. And we were talking about this afterwards.
And you once accused Noam of biting our father.
Yes,
which
he
Noam
did.
Defended himself and said he wouldn't have done that because it wasn't kosher.
And he just went on to have this biting criticism of American society. But anyway.
It got to the point with our mom that we begged her to act her age. She was in her late 70s. And to stop going to all these places that we hadn't gone yet.
But when she went to the occupied territories, she went with a group. And my parents had always spoken Hebrew to each other at home. Some language that they wanted us not to be able to understand so they could communicate with each other privately. And she was with a Palestinian tour guide. The Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint had promised that they could go through. And when the Palestinian tour guide came up to them and said, I think it was in Jericho or Bethlehem, and the sad thing is we can't even ask her now, the Israeli soldiers brushed him aside and said, you can't go through. And then my mother stepped forward. These Israeli soldiers could have been her grandchildren. She spoke a kind of medieval Hebrew. I think, maybe she said, you will part the ways. And those soldiers stepped aside. And their group went through, and the Palestinian tour guide put his arm around my mother, and he said, I'm sticking with you. And that has been our philosophy, and my other two brothers, all our lives. Our parents were a great guide to us about integrity. My dad was the head of a task force that integrated the schools of our community. We had a kind of de facto segregation, and we went with him when I was in fifth grade to every cafeteria and auditorium of the schools of our community and watched 1,000 screaming parents on all sides. He got death threats, and he judiciously guided this community to a more just educational system. And my older brother was in a high school newspaper at the time and was covering this. And I think that David and I really took from this that journalism is a way to pursue these issues of social justice. We were incredibly lucky to have my parents as guides all of our lives. And we hope with our work in the journalism that we do that we can just bring out the voices of people all over the world so that you can make up your own minds, but that we are not alone in the United States. We live in a globalized community, and the only thing that will save us is if we communicate with each other. And I think that's what journalism is all about.